Today we have a world of applications and websites, and we think of those as two different worlds. Well, in .NET, those become one thing.
We are providing you with the V1 of that technology today. As I said, it represents a tremendous amount of work.
Scott Guthrie walks in with what appears to be a fully functional version of Visual Studio that he wrote over the weekend.
It's a big thing to say, I'm going to introduce a brand new programming paradigm, and I'm going to convince all my developers to move over to it.
And Scott just cranked it out.
2010 actually marked the 10th anniversary of ASP.NET.
Today, we are open sourcing the entire Roslyn project.
Roslyn is now open source.
Thank you.
We have millions of mobile users using the native apps on each operating system.
We got to be able to stay in the language space that we were familiar with, which was writing on the .NET stack.
We also use .NET and Angular for our web-based solution, which integrates with Azure Cloud Services.
We've depended on .NET to drive all of our applications.
Chipotle.com has an ordering service. I understand that this is built in .NET.
Yes, our ordering platform is done in .NET Core, ASP.NET.
Welcome to .NET Conf 2020. I am so excited to be here on the 10th anniversary of .NET Conf and the .NET 5 launch. I'm Scott Hunter, Director of Program Management at Microsoft on .NET. Congrats to everybody on the great release today and 10 years of this virtual conference. It's been an incredible journey to get where we are today, and we could not have done it without the .NET community. Here are just a few of the memories we've shared over the years. From the first MVC conference with Scott Guthrie, then ASP Conf, and then expanded and renamed to .NET Conf. It has evolved into the world's largest .NET conference on the planet. We have 80 sessions for you this year. Over 100 speakers from all around the world. Over 20 generous sponsors giving away tons of prizes. And best of all, .NET 5 is available today. So I'm pleased to announce the general availability of .NET 5. You can go and download it right now. .NET 5 is the next version of .NET Core. We continue the journey of unifying the .NET platform. Our vision for 1.NET is a unified set of libraries, tools, SDKs, and runtimes. .NET 5 begins this journey by taking everything available in .NET Core and adding several cloud and web investments, such as smaller single-file applications that use less memory and are more appropriate for microservice and containerized applications across various operating systems. ASP.NET Blazor WebAssembly, which allows you to write web UI in C# and runs completely in the browser. Now, for the first time ever, it uses the core BCL instead of the mono BCL, further unifying the platform so developers can write code against the exact same base class libraries across all of .NET. .NET also embraces full Swagger support and makes it easier to create testable, compatible web APIs with OpenAPI, and we'll do a demo of that in a little bit. .NET 5 also includes full design time support for Windows desktop development, WinForms and WPF both, in Visual Studio, with first and third-party control support for the first time. Also, we've heard all the feedback from you. Click Once is now available again for full, and you still get all the features of .NET as well. Plus, there's tons of performance improvements, which I'm going to show in just a second. And we have support for Windows ARM 64. And there's also brand new versions of C# and F# in .NET 5. Let's talk about the ecosystem. We have seen significant growth in the .NET ecosystem over the last couple of years. If you look at this, you know, we shipped .NET Core for the first time in 2017. 3 years later, we have over 2 million developers using it every day. I think that's an amazing number. Stack Overflow has a great developer survey that they run every year. And for the last 2 years, we've been the number one most loved framework. I'd like to call out that, you know, we open sourced .NET kind of late in 2014, but the Cloud Native Foundation, when they monitor the highest velocity OSS projects, we find that .NET is in the top 30 against a ton of awesome other products as well. So it's great to see that the how much pickup we've had in the open source world. And then we're the top five language in GitHub as well. And Tech Empower, this is a public benchmark which measures frameworks. We are one of the fastest frameworks there. And that's one of our goals to you, the customer, to make sure that you realize you can run your .NET applications faster and better than you could in any other language. And then we love the fact that when we take developer surveys of new customers coming onto the platform, about 40% of them are, new to the platform. I'm going to switch over and show something really cool. So I'm going to change my browser. Here we go. This is a cool page called .NET Thanks.AzureWebsites.net. And what this does, you can go to this yourself right now. And on this page, you're going to see a link to all of our releases. And if I go click on one of these, I'll click on RC2. Well, let's go click on 318. This will show you all the people that have contributed to this product. And so this is showing you that open source world out there. And from this page, you can see all the versions and all the contributions that we take. Let me switch back. Now let's talk about adoption. Our user base keeps growing. There are over 5 million active .NET developers today in the Visual Studio family, which includes Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, and Visual Studio for Mac. As I mentioned, we've seen significant growth in .NET Core, our open source cross-platform .NET, with over 2 million active developers per month. We've also seen a significant number of Windows desktop developers. So when we shipped WinForms and WPF with .NET Core 3.1, I never thought that within under a year, we would have 100,000 each moving to .NET Core. And they're doing that because they want those perf benefits, they want that side-by-side, all those capabilities that we bring in the platform. And then finally, .NET Core, .NET 5 is cross-platform. And we're seeing all these developers start using our published to Linux as well. So we're happy to see this great adoption across the entire platform. Now, I can't talk about .NET without talking about some of the awesome partners that we have out there. If you look here, all of these people, DevExpress, Infragistics, Telerik, Grape City, JQ Widgets, Radzen, and Syncfusion, they all have products available for .NET 5 today. Whether that's controls for Blazor, controls for WinForms, or controls for WPF, they're all out there. And what's even cooler is with .NET 5, I don't want to just talk about commercial partners. As I mentioned earlier, we have this great velocity in OSS, and we have an amazing list of open source partners as well. And some of these on this page, like Identity Server and Swashbuckle, they're actually in the product. A lot of these are because, as I wanted to show, we have a demo later on that Dan Roth's gonna do, and I wanted to show those commercial Blazor extensions and then also show some open source ones side by side with them. And so we have a great demo showing that. But I just want to say, we have an amazing community. I can't list them all here. There's many more in the .NET Foundation. So check these out. Tech Empower. This is a big part of .NET to me. If you look here, developers are running critical services in production. And they care both about perf and they care about cost as well. And so all the perf that we've added in .NET helps run your applications cheaper and faster than you could with any other platform. This is showing what our perf was in 3.1, which we shipped a year ago. Now let's move forward and let's look at the improvements that you're gonna see in .NET 5. You can see here, plain text is up 38%. We've increased JSON serialization benchmark by 42%. And Fortunes, which is the hardest application for us to run because that's doing web pages, it's making database calls, we've had a 20% year-over-year improvement. So you can see massive performance gains across the entire platform here. Next, let's talk about some other improvements. Sockets, 30% improvement in socket performance on Linux compared to 3.1. JSON serialization, which I just mentioned before, has improved by about 20% over the two platforms. And then serialization of large collections and arrays, we've made that 3 times faster and it's zero alloc. Zero alloc means we don't garbage collect, your application runs faster. And for modern contract-based APIs, we added gRPC in 3.1. And you can see that as we get to 5, we are actually faster than Go, C++, and Java. So you know if you actually move your application to .NET 5, it's gonna run super fast and super efficient. So next, what I want to do is I want to talk about Windows desktop development and what we've done in this space. So if you look here, what we've done is we've added in this version full support for the WinForm and WPF designers. Those designers have been in preview since we shipped .NET Core 3.1, but we're finally adding the final touches to that. We have click once. That was the most requested feature from WinForms and WPF developers, was being able to right click on their application, publish it, and so they could have a simple setup they could just pass around the internet with updates as well. So, you know, a click once application, once you publish a new version of it, any customer running it the next time will be asked to migrate to the new ones. And then, of course, I mentioned on those earlier slides, we have all those arrays of third-party controls out there, and they're now starting to light up in our tools. And also, you get all the benefits of .NET. You get self-contained single-file exes if you want, no .NET on the machine at all. You get awesome performance, and you also get new things like, you know, if you've seen the new Edge that we have, we now have a Edge control that you can actually put into WinForm application. And with that, I want to invite Scott Hanselman on the stage here, and let's do a demo of modernizing a desktop app with WinForms.
How are you, sir?
Excellent. How are you doing?
Living the dream. Living the dream. Cool. So I'll go ahead and share my screen here. And what we've done is just put together just a little application here in Visual Studio. You can see a couple of interesting things over here showing the different runtimes that we can run on. And I'm, of course, on x64 right now. And I've got my WinForms application right here. Now, if I just run this application by itself, I'll bring it in over from my other monitor. You can see that we've got a WinForms application. There's my default app, my default icon, and I've got a web page in the middle there. You may have seen applications or have wanted an application in the past that has, you know, a web page in the middle. Myself, when I started in WinForms nigh these 20 years ago, I, in fact, had an ActiveX control, and it was Edge. Internet Explorer, rather, and you know, you had like a control within this. Well, what's going on here, this is, in fact, the Chromium-based Microsoft Edge running as a control inside of WinForms, which is incredibly powerful to be able to mix the best of Windows and Win32 and WinForms with the best of the web. This is a great experience. So check this out. If I go and double click on that inside of this .NET 5 application, I'm going to go ahead and close up these things in the toolbox here. We see that, in fact, just by bringing in references to different NuGet packages, I didn't have to install anything. I just referenced some NuGet packages. I've actually got some Telerik UI for WinForms that have appeared in the toolbox. So that toolbox on the left gets populated by adding these NuGet packages. Now you can see here where we've got our web view. It's called Web View 2, which is one better than the regular web view. It in fact has Edge. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a little trick here. I'm going to pull this down. I've hidden some controls underneath. And then on the left-hand side under Toolbox, I'm going to go and search for the drop-down list that I want to use. I think it's called drop-down. I'll use the RAD drop-down list from Telerik here. And I'm going to go and lay it out in my visual designer right here. And then over in the properties area, let's go ahead and give it a name like Scott drop-down list. Okay. Now I'm going to hit F7. Look at the code behind this. I've got a class, public class Scott, that takes a name and a Twitter UI. So this is for your favorite Scots. And then what we do here is we've got a list of your favorite Scots. You too can be a Scott. You don't have to be named Scott to be a Scott. And I'm going to uncomment out where I set the data source to that list of Scott. And I'm going to then style that list. Okay. Now I'm going to go and build this application and then run it. This will be coming up on a on another monitor, so I'll bring it over from the other monitor. And now I've got a WinForms application written in .NET 5 with a Telerik WinForms control, dropdowns, bound, that is then affecting an Edge-based control running in WinForms, but it's Chromium-based Edge. Fantastic stuff, pretty impressive. I was impressed at how easy it was. And what's cool about this, now if we go back to what Scott Hunter was saying, if I right click and say publish and go and publish this to a folder, check this out. we can go and publish this with Click Once. Now, there may have been some challenges with Click Once in the past, but a lot of work has been done to make Click Once lovely. And if you take Click Once and you combine that with some of the new features of .NET 5, you get something really special. So we've got our different options and whatnot for our Click Once application. But take a look down here. Target framework, .NET 5. I could go and make it, you know, self-contained. I could make a single file. We could go and spin this thing up into a single file. I could just hand it to you. I could deploy it and turn it into a setup.exe, and you could go and run that. I could make a Click Once app. Lot of flexibility. But imagine the idea that you could take a WinForms application that in the past would require a version of .NET framework that might require a reboot of Windows or some, you know, making sure that all of the Windows machines in your fleet are up to date and doing what you need them to do. But now you don't have to worry about any of that. It's completely self-contained, one executable, the ability to do a simple click once, the ability to bring in controls, no COM registration, none of that stuff. And you get great high DPI support because the team has been putting lots of work into WinForms to make it work on 4K monitors like the one that I am working on right now. Where is Scott Hunter? Are you still around, sir?
Can you go into the source code for the application?
Oh, yeah. Let's do this.
Let's do that C# 9 feature called records. I think that'd be a great thing to show.
Yeah. So this is my Scott class. And we've all written this, right? Public class person, constructor. Pass some stuff into the parameters. Oh, yeah, you've got public properties. We've all done this a million times. It's fine. But all that code, boop, you can turn that into a record. This is a new C# 9 feature where we're going to say, you know, this is a data transfer object. This is, it's a class, but it's a record. So all that boilerplate disappears. So I just got to refactor via subtraction. Isn't that great? That is the exact same code. This is really important. I still have a constructor. I still have public properties. I still have my typing. I still have my getter setter, but expressed in this nice shorthand. And you'll notice, look, it's still compiled. You can see right there, my squigglies go away. Great C# 9 feature and still works. So this is really interesting as well. You're pointing out how clean that is. You've got WinForms refreshed for the next generation, works great in Windows, 4K. You've got the brand new Chromium-based Edge, C# 9 features, single file executable, ready to run, and Click Once installer. Pretty yummy, I must say.
Now Scott, it's I saw this app had Hunter and Hanselman, but it also had Scott Guthrie.
We haven't talked to Scott in a while, have we? I think about him often, and I say to myself, self, how is Scott Guthrie? He's, you know, he's a younger man than I, but he has found much success in life. So while you and I are relegated to the historical middle management trash heap, he has gone off and he's changed the world with Azure and his great, great team there. So I wish him well, and I raise my generic fizzy soda to him.
Let's bring Scott in the call.
Hi, folks. How are you?
How's it going, sir?
Good. How are you?
I'm glad I wore this shirt today.
I did too, conveniently, although I wear it most days.
I've got, Scott, I've got an ASP.NET shirt today.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm cool. AFC Richmond, but that's the best red shirt I could find.
Shirt somewhere in my closet, actually.
So, Scott, we heard this rumor that you have this like spec of ASP.NET from back in the early days in paper form.
I do. Yeah. We were chatting the other day and this is the original spec. I think I started this in 1997. And this is the notes and all. So I got like the original printed spec. And then these are, I even have like the building numbers where I'm supposed to run to go to a meeting. I don't know what that phone number is, but and it's got like, you know, all the questions as we're working through it on how things work. You know, and what the URL syntax is and the architecture for how it would, you know, you can see like init, execute, transmit. So that was the early eventing model. And then I'm trying to think somewhere in here, there's, you can see a lot changed in terms of, you know, this because we were spending a lot of time, just trying to figure out how this thing would work. And, you know, met with a lot of customers and we're trying to figure out, okay, well, how would this map to, this was a site called Sidewalk, which Microsoft used to have. I think it long since disappeared. And it was, you know, just trying to figure out, okay, how would we build this using what became ASP.NET? And then this is I don't think this is the first spec, but this is the oldest one I have on my bookshelf. But you can see it was called XSP, was the code name. A little known secret is if you look at the extension of ASPX, the X comes from XSP. It's also a plus turned side by side. And then this, even here, we even have, you know, public class foo extends page. And we've got the member components and init form and a bunch of other stuff in there. A lot changed, but yeah, it's, you know, old.
Hansman and I were asking ourselves last night, was ASP.NET the invention, was a postback created by ASP.NET? Was that something that came out of this effort, or was that something that was in the web before?
Well, the web had, I mean, there were lots of approaches people were doing back in 97. I mean, you have to remember, 97, one of the challenges was not every browser supported JavaScript yet. And so one of the design criteria for ASP.NET 1.0 was to work with a browser that didn't support JavaScript, which sounds surreal now, but that, believe it or not, that was the state of the world back then. And so, you know, there was, you know, there were ways that you could do callbacks in JavaScript, because there was a, what was the name of it? It was the
LiveScript.
It was LiveScript, and then there was a inner frame, I think, was also had the object model that you could call something and then look at the response. And it, you know, later had lots of cross-site scripting attacks and all that stuff. But that was the approach people were using to like hand roll JavaScript to call things back. And but the downside was if you had no JavaScript, it wouldn't, or JavaScript wasn't enabled, it wouldn't work. And so what we came up with Postback, which was kind of interesting, was both kind of the equivalent of it. So you could hook in JavaScript, but it was a form submit. And so even if you had JavaScript disabled, believe it or not, the original Postback would still work. And then, you know, two guys I worked with, Ken and Ted, to the credit, they came up with a lot of the ideas of, you know, how Postback would work in terms of like, you know, hydrating objects. Actually, for them, I think they came up with the idea of, you know, let's rehydrate the tree. And is there some kind of syntax we could do it? The original way we did it was on the server side. And then we came up with this notion of kind of this object bag that we squiggled away in VueScript or VueState. And then I can't remember someone else. Remember who exactly, but it's, you know, then the trick was like, hey, can you actually fake out VueState to do something bad? And so then we came up with a whole hashing mechanism for VueState, and yeah, the rest was history. And so yeah, that was that most of that stuff happened in 98 and early 99, and then there's a lot of refinement, and so we figured out along the way. And then I think the biggest thing we did also then that we did well, partly because we were still trying to figure out the page syntax and you know how the forms model would work, is we said, you know, we might not get this right, and so let's make sure we layer it correctly. And so the whole IHTTP handler and IHTTP module and the whole extensibility of ASP.NET, you know, we kind of came up with to make sure that if we ever wanted to replace web forms in the future, we could. And you know, later when we introduced ASP.NET MVC, it meant that, you know, most of ASP.NET could be reused, and then we could just replace, you know, effectively the page object with, you know, the controller object and kind of swivel the whole extensibility around. But it was, you know, it was extensible enough that even in the first ASP.NET MVC, we used web forms as the view engine. And, you know, it was kind of cool that we were able to have that much flexibility. And that's, you know, that's something I try to do even today when I do reviews with teams and give feedback on architecture is, you know, layer it really cleanly because you never know what you're going to need to do in the future. And if it's all bundled together in a giant ball of wine or a ball of twine, then you're going to have to start over if you don't get it right the first time. So, yeah.
There's a lot of people who have been saying, and the legend has been building over the years, that much of ASP.NET was built on airplanes going from customer to customer or from meeting to meeting. How much truth is in that? What was actually written on an airplane?
Well, most of the original ASP.NET was not written on an airplane. And you know, mostly because laptops back then only had about an hour of battery life, and planes did not have power adapters. You know, I feel like I'm dating myself here, but and so you know, most of the original ASP.NET, or the original prototype of ASP.NET, I guess I wrote over the Christmas New Year's between '97 and '98, and I was working with Mark Anders, and I kind of started the project, and you know, a lot of these notes and things came from ideas. And at some point he said, we should write a prototype and I nominate you. And so this is before the CLR existed. So I built the prototype with, three things actually. I had some C++, that I was writing for the ISAPI, which was like the interface into IIS at the time. Which is a super unfun interface. And so that was sort of like how you hosted it. And that was still how ASP.NET was hosted for the first many, many years. And then there was a friend of mine, who was actually my roommate at the time, worked on the JavaScript engine at Microsoft. And he knew about this private version of the JavaScript engine that you could inject Java objects into. And so you could write COM interfaces for JavaScript using the JVM or using J++, and it would expose it as idispatch COM objects, which was another super unfun interface way back in the day. And so I was able to kind of build this object-oriented object model in Java originally, and then you could kind of like, you know, inject it into the JavaScript engine. And of course, this is before JavaScript had types or a whole bunch of things. But it basically meant you could use these things as objects. And I built like a parser. I don't even remember what language I used the parser in. And so it would you know, read the ASP.NET page. It would find JavaScript inside it and effectively hydrate a class object derived from these object-oriented Java objects I'd created. And it was kind of, you know, a monstrosity of a prototype. But it worked. And it was such that, you know, you could literally create a back then .xsp page, stick, I didn't have ASP colon data grid, but I had XSP colon data grid. And so I actually had a data grid control and a few other controls. And then you could write the effective, you know, page event handlers in JavaScript embedded in the page running on the server side. And it kind of all worked. And so that was the original prototype. And I think I came back in January 98 with that working. And so it was sort of over the holidays that I wrote it, mostly in my apartment, and came back and showed that. And then people said, hey, that looks kind of interesting. And Dmitry Rubsman joined, I think, in February or March on the team and became eventually the dev manager and engineering leader, for .NET. He's still, in DevDiv today. And, folks like David Ebo joined, I think it's like 6 months later, and it's Nikhil and others, and so it's, you know, it's been a fun journey.
What do you think?
Yeah, I did write on a plane, so I think that's where the rumor of I wrote something on a plane.
NBC.
That was it.
What do, you, What do you feel about Blazor when you see Blazor today and you look back to what you were doing and thinking about your apartment and then how the web is gone? You've got WebAssembly and now we're running .NET in the browser in a VM inside of JavaScript. Like, you think about things like that?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, it's, I think it's all, I mean, I'd say a couple of things. I mean, one is it's awesome to see how much the world's changed technology wise. I mean, you know, this is, you know, it sounds weird even saying, I mean, I hadn't thought about the fact that JavaScript didn't even exist when we first came out with ASP.NET, probably for 20 years. So, you know, just recalling this actually got me thinking about that. And so, you know, just thinking about we've gone from there is no JavaScript or you can't depend on JavaScript to we now have a compiled WebAssembly running in an engine and you can, you know, use things like Blazor and C# to target it. It's kind of, it's almost like science fiction how far it's come. And at the same time, it's kind of cool that, you know, when you look at ASP.NET and .NET today, so many of the concepts and types and classes and syntax are still around. And so I'd say it's rare in the tech industry where you have something that a bunch of stuff that doesn't change over a, you know, we're coming up on, was it 23 years now? We're coming up to 24 years next spring. And yet at the same time, you know, everything has changed. And so, you know, it's kind of cool to see, you know, both the technology, but then also the community. I mean, it's, you know, looking at the two Scotts here and looking at a lot of the folks on the team. I mean, it's great to see that the community has been, you know, so alive and so active for, you know, now we're in our third decade. I mean, that's
well, I don't know if you probably haven't heard, but I recently made a big move in my blog to Azure. I heard it was going to be quite popular, but my blog was WebForms, ASP.NET 1.1. You remember Clemens Vasters wrote DOS blog.
Yeah.
And so Mark Downey on the Visual Studio team, with a little help from me, moved it over to .NET Core. So I'm running .NET Core on Azure, still running DOS blog, 20 years of blogging, and I was able to move it over, and the CPU is like 0.1%, and it's so much faster. And I can't believe that I've reused 70-75% of the code that we started with back almost 20 years ago.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah, it's, you know, and it's you know, we're not perfect by any stretch, but it's kind of cool to see kind of just, you know, this, there's not many things in the tech industry where that's true. I mean, if you look at, you know, Java, or you look at other programming languages, or you look at other tools, I mean, it's, you typically, the half-life on technology is measured in a single digit years and usually low numbers. And you know, I think it's both testament to the technology, it's testament to the team, and it's, you know, really testament to the community. And, you know, I think the other thing that we've always tried to do in our communities is just learn. And so, you know, if you can constantly evolve, you can constantly survive. If you ever stop learning or stop evolving tech, you're in trouble. And, you know, I love how, you know, even take the first version of ASP.NET MVC, the fact that we use the WebForms engine, you know, in a perfect world, we probably wouldn't have done that in the very first version, but it meant that, you know, it was familiar and we brought people forward, and then, you know, we changed to Razor and, you know, evolved with .NET Core and Blazor. And it's, you know, it's a nice continuous set of improvements so that the tech doesn't get stale, but at the same time, there's continuity so that you're not leaving people behind. And, you know, I think that's a great approach to have in this world.
Cool. Well, thanks a million, Scott, for being at the first .NET Conf, which was MVC Conf. Thanks for coming back 10 years later, and hopefully we'll have you back in the future as well.
Definitely. No, thanks, everyone. And thank you, everyone in the community watching this, in terms of everything you're doing as well. And thanks to the two Scotts for carrying the torch and driving everything as well as, you know, the way you are. That makes an enormous difference, and it's always fun to reminisce, and love to come back anytime.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay.
Cool. All right.
Thanks, Scott.
See you later, sir.
So with that, thanks, Scott Guthrie. And now let's move on and talk about mobile. So Xamarin.Forms 5 is coming out later this year with tons of new features, like new APIs for brushes, shapes, and paths, letting you draw beautiful custom cross-platform UIs across Android, iOS, and Windows. There's much better XAML experience because we've actually improved the IntelliSense, and we have better diagnostics for data binding. And then we've actually taken the hot reload feature and rebuilt it from the ground up using the exact same tech that we have in WPF, UWP, and now in Xamarin. So we're giving you a fast, consistent experience across all of those UI techs, no matter what you're developing for. And the other cool feature about Xamarin Forms is you can start building cross-platform Xamarin apps right now with just an iPhone and a PC. And with that, how about we jump over and talk about the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Science. They are using Xamarin and .NET to deliver a multi-device streaming service to their Academy members. That's how people can actually watch the movies and nominate them and vote on them. They have petabytes of data and need to deliver a robust, secure solution that can run on any device. They were able to move their entire tech, ASP.NET websites and middle tier services to Azure App Service, SQL Server, and Azure SQL. And they were also able to use Azure DevOps to modernize their application infrastructure and development processes. So we have a cool video that we're going to kick off now to show you how they did this.
This is where I think this can't be in there, but just for you guys. I am Bev Kite. I'm the CIO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, otherwise known as the Oscars. The mission of the Academy is to recognize and uphold excellence in the motion pictures arts and sciences, and inspire imagination and connect the world through the medium of motion pictures. The Margaret Herrick Library contains items from as far back as 1928. They began collecting almost immediately as an organization. The motivation for digitizing is providing access to these incredible materials that the Academy has. It has about 10 million items in its library and over 100,000 items in its film archive. It's a lot of movies. It's a lot of moving parts. The award submission processes were largely in disparate systems, and the screening processes were largely through DVDs. So that was a difficult process for the Academy members and was not really something that was forward thinking. We wanted to build an app to get the best possible experience to our members and really get members involved, engaged, watching the movies and being able to vote. It was the perfect timing, the combination of wanting to actually stream assets, expand our streaming platform, expand the support on multiple different devices. And that's what led us to move up to the cloud. The Azure migration itself, I think, was about 6 to 8 months of planning and effort. We were a big .NET Microsoft shop. So our back-end systems were SQL Server, IIS, .NET, definitely app services. We're taking full advantage of those. We kept most of that as we moved this into the cloud. When we looked at what technology we wanted to use to develop the apps, we really felt that Xamarin was a good approach for us because we had that existing API infrastructure in .NET. In Azure, we're able to improve our DevOps processes so substantially and use slots to actually switch out a build and put in place a new build, so minimal downtime. We get a lot of positive feedback from our members, and it's been really fascinating because we have actually seen members stream when they are shooting movies in locations all around the world. I'm so grateful for the relationship we've had with Microsoft. It's just been an amazing journey. All of my team is so proud of what we've accomplished. We're very focused on doing the best we can by the membership, maintaining this legacy, making sure that what we produce is beautiful, powerful, secure, usable and highly available.
And the Oscar goes to...
Example of a real-world customer using .NET for their platform, and Xamarin as well. And next, let's move over here, and we'll talk about Xamarin, and I'll bring in Maddie Ledger to do a demo of the Xamarin Forms 5 stuff.
Cool. Thanks, Scott. If you're a .NET developer, you can build beautiful cross-platform native iOS, Android, and Windows apps with C# and .NET using Xamarin. We're making you more productive than ever with the new Xamarin experience. So let me show you this app I'm working on. I built it with Xamarin Forms UI. I've gotten really into buying plants this year, but I always forget how to take care of them, and I wanted to make an app to remind me how. I'm not an app designer, but I think it looks pretty good with only a few days of development so far. The first thing I want to introduce you to is XAML Hot Reload 2.0. Like Scott said, it's been rebuilt from the ground up to use the same tech as UWP and WPF Hot Reload. That makes it blazing fast, it adds support for Xamarin UWP apps, and it gives you the same experience you get hot reloading on UWP and WPF. So I can change the background color here. I get my rich IntelliSense, and as soon as I have valid XAML, my app updates, and I don't even have to save. And I can quickly change it back. I like the light green better. Another feature of XAML Hot Reload 2.0 is the new live visual tree. Here it shows every page and element in my app. You can see I'm using Xamarin Forms shell for my navigation. And in this tab page, I'm using some of the new Xamarin Forms 5 controls, like the carousel view and the indicator view. I can click on this icon right here. It takes me to where in my XAML it's defined. All right. This is only the start of the new productivity features we're bringing for Xamarin developers. So next, let's look at data binding. This app is supposed to show me the plant name up top right here. It's a value I'm data binding, but it's missing, so there must be an error. I can go into the new XAML binding diagnostics pane by clicking this button right here. Bam. Pops right up. I can see I spelled name wrong. And before I fix that, let me show you the same app running on Android. So I'm going to stop that, switch my projects. Like I said, you can target iOS, Android, and Windows with Xamarin. So I've got my Android emulator up and running already. I'm actually using my home computer right now. It's got an AMD CPU, built it myself. Very exciting. I can still use Hyper-V to accelerate my Android emulator here so it's faster than ever. Intel, AMD, whatever you want. This is actually my development workflow too when I write apps. I use VS, I use my Android emulator, and of course, sometimes I plug in my device when I want to start playing with it, unplug it, show it to friends, all that stuff. So it's going to spin up here. And what's important with this is that you're going to get the same experience no matter where you're debugging. So I can see Hot Reload's initializing in the bottom left here. My Android emulator is thinking and it pops right up. So let's fix that data binding issue. I see right here, it came up in the same XAML binding failures diagnostics window. So I can go find it in my code, wherever it is, in this carousel view, change it, I'll clear this, oh, and I'll swipe to the next one in this carousel view, refresh it, there I go. My title's right there with my nice custom embedded fonts in Xamarin Forms. And I still have my live visual tree as well, so it's the same experience that I just had on Windows, still got the same controls. It's the same XAML running on UWP and Android. And let's talk about getting this app debugging on iOS. So I'm going to use a new productivity tool in the works called Hot Restart for iOS, and it lets me quickly deploy and debug my iOS applications on my device from Windows. So I just Face ID unlocked my iPhone. I've got it plugged in right here. I'm going to AirPlay it using this really cool tool called Reflector, which lets me screen mirror onto my PC, and it always pops up on the other monitor. Pop it over here. Nice. Oh, hello. There we go. So this is just my phone, nothing fancy. And I can go in now when I change the startup project, make sure my CPU is to iPhone, and see my iPhone as a target in VS right now. So this is just plugged in over USB. And I've connected my free Apple developer account with Visual Studio so that Windows can provision my device. And it's gonna build and deploy the debug version of this app to the iPhone. So my iPhone pops up. And to distribute this in the store, I do need a Mac, but I actually have not built this app yet on my Mac. I have to update it, and I don't want to. So this has all been developed for iOS on Windows. And it only takes a few seconds to deploy the app, which is a vast improvement over creating the full package it usually needs for deployment. So I can swipe through my app. I can use the same things as I have been using on all the other platforms. I've got my live visual tree. I've got my my hot reload. Change that up. Thank you, IntelliSense. And it immediately updates. So the best part about this is that everything I showed you today, you can use right now with the latest Visual Studio 2019. So the version 16.8 comes out today. And all these Xamarin Forms 5 features come later this year. There's previews available now, and you'll hear more about them in some of the talks later this afternoon and later this week. So enjoy .NET Conf and get started writing your cross-platform mobile apps with .NET and Xamarin.
And now, as we move on, let's talk about Visual Studio. Obviously, we don't ship a new version of .NET without having a new version of Visual Studio with a bunch of capabilities as well. So happy to announce today that we have the GA of Visual Studio 2019 16.8. And there's now a new preview of 16.9 as well, and a bunch of new stuff. Obviously, .NET 5 is included in the box. There's a bunch of productivity improvements. One of my favorite ones is we have a bunch of Roslyn analyzers that you can use, and you used to have to go find those somewhere on the internet. They're now in .NET projects by default. Another cool feature in 16.8 is that a brand new Git experience to make using Git even easier inside of Visual Studio. There's awesome support for Linux debugging. If you want to go build a .NET 5 project and run it on Linux, you can do all of that in Windows using Windows Subsystem for Linux 2.0. We have an improved XAML experience. We talked about that a little bit in the Xamarin area. And then another area that I'm super excited about is you can now take a .NET project and right-click publish it, not to a cloud endpoint, but to GitHub Actions. So you can have a full CI/CD flow using GitHub Actions right from the tool. Super easy to use. And so there's that and a lot more included in the new version of Visual Studio that ships with .NET 5. And with that, I want to introduce Kendra Havens to come in and show us some of these cool new features.
Thanks, Scott. So I'm really excited to start talking about GitHub Codespaces. I'm excited to start on a new team because I have instant setup. So Visual Studio is more connected to the developer cloud than ever. Let me show you what all that means. So GitHub Codespaces is currently in a limited beta, so you do have to sign up for it. But once you do, you'll get this new box connecting to a Codespace. And initialization is really easy. All you need is your repository URL, and you can set up what instance types you want. So if you want to get more of that cloud power, you can. So I already have one set up, and this is my IDE connected to basically a cloud environment. So all of my builds, my source code, everything is happening, or my test runs, everything is happening in that environment and not on my local machine. So I get to save my local resources, my battery power. I'm not limited by the hardware I have on hand. And I didn't need to install a ton of dependencies every time I start working in a new repository. So part of this magic is the devinit.json, and there's a talk on this later with Vix and Andy tomorrow. But this automatically documents for all repo maintainers what this repo needs installed on its environment to run successfully. So it'll go and grab the Azure CLI, SQL Server, Chaco. It'll run .NET tools to install. All kinds of things that it'll automatically get for you. So easy to get started. So my first commit for this repo, it looks like there's some code style that I can actually fix up. And even though I'm new, I know what this code style is because I'm getting prompts in Visual Studio to keep using outside of my namespace. I can change var to use explicit type. And I know what all of the code style is because it's all documented in an editor config file. So this file lives at the root of your repo and lets you know what the code style is for this particular solution. And Visual Studio can read it and then give you prompts, as you saw the three dots and stuff I was using, to apply consistent code style across your team. So I've made a couple of edits, so I can go ahead and save those. And what I want to do is push. So when I push, this will actually kick off a GitHub workflow. So let me show you what that looks like. It's really easy to set up. you can go and right click on your solution and go to our publish dialogues. And creating one is super simple. Lots of, I can even deploy to an Azure App Service on Linux and it'll spin it all up for me. I actually didn't need to leave this dialog in order to set up like my App Service instance. I just clicked this plus button. So it loads what I already have. And then I can publish this workflow file all through this dialog. So let's take a look at the one I already have set up. So this is looking at what branch it needs to be triggered on. So as soon as I push, if I go over to where this repo is on GitHub and I click actions, we should be able to see, there's my code cleanup action that was triggered as soon as I pushed. So it's running through a bunch of build steps right now. So it's super easy to create and set up. It's actually running on Ubuntu. So, and I had the latest .NET 5 version, and it's running a bunch of steps that I've already kind of said. I want to do a .NET restore. I want to run tests. So you can see it'll get to running tests there in a second. But what I actually want to do, since this app is running on Linux, normally before I deploy, I'd actually want to get feedback from my tests from Linux, since I know that's the end target. But it's hard to do that from Visual Studio right now. So I want to show you something that's super, super new. It's not even in the preview right now. Everything else I've shown you is in the Visual Studio preview. So I'll go ahead and switch versions because this is a very early sneak peek of remote test execution in Visual Studio. So this is the idea of connecting your Test Explorer over SSH. So you could connect with WSL, you can connect to containers, you can connect to machines on-prem or on server someday at some point. We're very excited about it. So how this works, and those machines can run tests and your Test Explorer can get feedback from there. So how this works is you have a new dropdown, I guess, in the Test Explorer, and this is specified in a sort of a test runtime.json. And this one, for example, is pointing at a particular Docker image that I have set up. So when I go to my Test Explorer and I set it to Linux, it kind of rediscovers those tests in a container, and I can actually run from the container. So you saw that I had a test that was running on Windows and it was passing, and now it's run on Linux and it's passing. So, and the Windows is failing. So it's just an example of how you can change your target environments and get feedback from machines that are a different target platform right in Visual Studio. So if I go back to my pipeline, looks like I've deployed, I'm just publishing some artifacts, and then I'll be good to go. So I can go ahead and hit my app in where it's deployed. And that's my little Blazer memory game, kind of the classic card game where you try to find matching pairs. So let's see. That's Visual Studio connected with the cloud, making setup and scaling really easily with GitHub Codespaces and helping you create GitHub workflows that can deploy your app to Azure and manage your pipeline, all from Visual Studio. And back to you, Scott.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kendra. So with that, Visual Studio, what's next? Let's talk about web and cloud development. So .NET 5 includes support for building full-stack .NET web apps using Blazor Server or Blazor WebAssembly. Blazor WebAssembly apps can now use the core framework libraries from .NET 5, giving them full access to the entire .NET 5 API surface area. Runtime performance in Blazor WebAssembly is 2 to 3 times faster than in previous releases. Also, Blazor WebAssembly now supports server-side pre-rendering to make your pages load a lot faster the very first time, and lazy loading of app dependencies, so you only load stuff as you actually start hitting them. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to have Dan Roth come in and show you some of these new awesome Blazor features in a second. Before I get to Dan, I want to start with Postage. Postage is a startup company created around an application that could help people with end-of-life planning. The founder and CEO had lost 3 family members in a very short period of time, and she wanted to create an affordable solution for people that could spend time grieving, not chasing down all the massive amounts of paperwork. They use .NET and Visual Studio to build a solution using ASP.NET Blazor, Xamarin, and Azure to rapidly create a secure solution. The coolest part about their project is they were able to save time and personal cost using .NET end-to-end because they could develop all the pieces in C#, which reduced the amount of code they had to write significantly. And with that, let's show a video real quick.
In September of 2018, I lost both grandmothers and my cousin's 13-month-old. There were things that we didn't think about. How are we going to get information on their pension or their 401k? Really, you should be focused on processing that loss and celebrating life. I started the postage because I just knew there had to be a better way. The postage is really a platform that allows you to organize your affairs. Whether it's your assets, your passwords, your memories, the postage provides that.
There are a lot of technical challenges when it comes to building a platform that is going to host so many important documents for people. We need to be able to store all of that, and we need to keep it all in a secure environment. We need to make sure that it stays up all the time. We chose to go with Microsoft because they had everything that we needed in order to deliver on our promise for the customers. We use Azure DevOps to create our pipelines and do our releases. We leverage Azure SQL, Azure Storage, Cosmos DB. We're focused on Blazor for our web technologies and Xamarin for our mobile technologies. With Blazor, it gave us the opportunity to have both the front end and the back end done by the same people. We're able to get web applications that are written in C#. It used to take us so much more code to write. It's amazing.
We ended up having a beta back in June 2020, getting a 61% conversion rate.
We went out of beta in September and have been in full launch since.
We're really excited about where we're starting off, but we've got a long road to go, and I'm really excited to help our users change the way they plan for the future.
Cool. And that's a great example of a startup using Blazor to build an awesome application. And so with that, I want to introduce Dan Roth to come up and show us a demo of some of these new features in Blazor on .NET 5.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Hi, everyone. Blazor is your web UI framework for building single-page web apps with just .NET. No JavaScript required. Let's take a look at what Blazor in .NET 5 has to offer. So .NET 5 includes support for both Blazor Server and Blazor WebAssembly, as you can see here in Visual Studio. Now, previously, if you were building a Blazor WebAssembly app, I have an old one here, you would target .NET Standard. But in .NET 5, by comparison, we now target .NET 5, and you have access to all the .NET 5 APIs using the same core framework libraries used on the server and desktop. This is the beginning of one .NET, and we expect that Xamarin will make a similar move for .NET 6. Now, just because you have all those APIs available, it doesn't mean all of them work in the browser. That's because Blazor still has to run in the browser security sandbox. But fortunately, the new compatibility analyzer will let you know when you try to use an API that's not going to work in the browser. For example, browsers don't have a console that you can read from. So if I try to call console.readline from my Blazor WebAssembly app, you can see I get a nice warning here letting me know that that API is not going to work in the browser. Cool. Performance is also significantly improved in Blazor WebAssembly in .NET 5. Component rendering and general runtime execution are 2 to 3 times faster. This is thanks to optimizations across the stack, including in the WebAssembly runtime, the core libraries, and in Blazor's rendering engine. We've also made it so Blazor WebAssembly apps load faster. So here's my .NET 5 Blazor WebAssembly app. I'm going to mash on the refresh button, and you can see that it appears to load almost instantly. There's no loading dot, dot, dot. And this is because in .NET 5, we've added support for Blazor WebAssembly pre-rendering. Let's go look at the code in the server. Here in this host.cshtml file, this is just a Razor page. We're rendering the component for the app, and we're using that new Blazor WebAssembly pre-rendered functionality. This gets pixels on the screen as fast as possible while the runtime is downloaded in the background. Blazor also now has built-in support for component virtualization to speed up rendering of large lists of data. Let's go back to the app. And I've got this fetch data page. It's a little different. Let's imagine now we're in the future when we can predict the weather as far out as we want. This table of weather forecasts has almost 10,000 rows. Let me bring this up side by side with Visual Studio. Let me grab, yes. All right, let's take a look at the fetch data component. All right, and so here we can see the new virtualize component, which will only render the data that is currently visible on the screen. It will also only fetch the data that needs to be rendered at that given point in time. So if we go back to the browser, let me F12 to bring up the browser DevTools. Now watch as I scroll down, we can see that requests start being sent to request just the data that needs to be shown on the screen, and just those rows are then rendered. And that makes the table rendering and scrolling fast and smooth. Now .NET 5 is also about making building component libraries easier. And in Blazor, we now have support for CSS and JavaScript isolation. Let me go back to the project. So here in this solution, I also have a component library, a Razor class library down here at the bottom. And this has a very simple component. Let me actually make this bigger again. Here, a very simple component that just has a div, very simple. But you'll notice down here at the bottom, it's got its own CSS file, a razor.css file. Let me open that up for you. These are styles that will apply just to this one component. So they won't affect other the styles of other parts of the application. Also, when I reference this component library from my application, I'm going to use the component from that class library from my index page. All right. So I don't need to actually reference those CSS styles. They'll be brought in automatically. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to add my component from the homepage of the app. And I'm just going to click save. And VS is going to do something cool here. Watch the tab, see the little icon. It's going boop, 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 boop. It automatically refreshes the browser for me. And there's my component. It's showing up with all of its CSS styles without me having to add anything. I love that new live refresh feature in Visual Studio where it will watch for code changes, rebuild the app, and auto refresh the browser for me. That same functionality is also available from the command line now using .NET Watch. Now, speaking of component libraries, no Blazor app would be complete without a great set of UI components. I've been working on this little application here, and Blazor component libraries are available from all the major component vendors and from many great open source projects. This is a little project that lets me log into GitHub and then search for GitHub issues in a given repo. I've got this little auto search box. Let's pick the ASP.NET Core repo. It's rendering a table and a progress bar down at the bottom, rendering all the issues from the ASP.NET Core repo, and I can filter and search and do all these things. So this app is using components from all sorts of great component vendor libraries, and also from the open source ecosystem. So we've got this Blazor type ahead component. That's what's that using that I'm using for that search box. We've got the DevExpress grid going on here. We've got the SyncFusion progress bar. This triage editor is my own component, but that's using the Blazor Strap modal dialog. Then inside there, we also have this label selector that's using the Radzen select bar. There are awesome components from Grape City and Infragistics. I think Scott showed Telerik components earlier with WinForms, so we thought it was only fair to show some of the other component vendors as well, though Telerik also has great Blazor components too. So no matter what kind of web app you're trying to build, Blazor in .NET 5 has everything you need. Back to you, Scott.
Thanks, Daniel. Okay, let's talk about cloud-native investments. This has been a huge area that we focused on in .NET these last couple of years. I want to talk about REST APIs first. .NET 5 brings full support for open API directly into your web APIs, meaning you can actually build, test much easier, and publish these things to things like Azure API Management as well. Plus, you can do client generation. The Swagger generated by Open API lets us actually generate the client for you. So just like you could in WCF in the past, you can create a web API and then right click and create a client to call it, all built in. Super excited about that. gRPC lets you build high performance contract based APIs. This is more similar to WCF. And we do the same thing for you as well. Basically, you have to write what's called a protofile, which describes your API, and then we'll generate the server-side code for you and the client code to call that server-side code automatically. And as I showed earlier in the slides, we have world-class performance here. So super, super awesome performance. Let's talk about some more investments. Smaller, faster microservices. One of the cool things that we've done in .NET 5 is for the first time ever, you can take an ASP.NET project and select that you want to link it and trim it. And that'll generate basically a small 20 meg self-contained application that requires no .NET on the machine at all to run. Another cool feature we've written is something called top-level programs. This lets you get right to the code. You can build your web API or your gRPC much smaller and much faster by removing all the boilerplate about having a class and a main and that kind of stuff. You can build a microservice in about 10 lines of code in .NET now. And then one of my favorite areas here is, you know, you probably heard of containers and Kubernetes and Docker and all those things. We have a cool project we're working on right now called Project Tai, which makes it super easy to build, debug, and deploy microservices very quickly. We'll do a demo of that in a second. And then I mentioned earlier in the tools, we have support for cross-platform development with WSL2 and Linux. And then we're also building a high-performance reverse proxy as a project to seed into the Cloud Native Foundation. Now, this is probably the most exciting thing for me to say today is we have .NET 5 available in Azure App Service today. You don't have to wait. You can start using your .NET 5 in Azure App Service right now. The only caveat you need to be aware of is you will need to create your service in the portal first. You can't create that inside of Visual Studio yet. But if you go to the portal, create a .NET 5 application, you can then use the Visual Studio tools, publish it right up, and start using the application today. And with that, I want to switch over to Brady Gaster and have him do a demo of building APIs on .NET 5.
Thanks, Scott. I'm really excited to show this today. I'm not quite as excited to show you this as I am about what you just said about .NET 5 being on app service on day zero. This is a pretty close second. So I'm an API developer, and one of the things that I've tried to do on the team is to make it easier for other API developers like myself. So like Scott said, I want to go ahead and show you something brand new in the web API project. I'm just going to go ahead and make a new weather API here, and I'll hit create. And I want to go ahead and make sure that I select ASP.NET Core 5 or .NET 5 here in VS. You'll see that I've got the ASP.NET Core web API project selected. And look here, this checkbox, enable open API support, it's checked by default. That's because API developers really ought to be using open API or Swagger, if you know it as I know it, to be describing their APIs so that people can, like Scott said, generate clients, import them into Azure API management, use them with third parties, and build power apps with them. We have all kinds of capabilities we'll talk about tomorrow in another session. But first, thanks to the fantastic open source project known as Swashbuckle, we've worked closely with that team. You can see here that your package references now include Swashbuckle ASP.NET Core, which looks at my web API controllers and generates the open API right by default, just like we used to do with ASMX files and WSDL. I'll go ahead and open up this controller, show you it's just a normal controller. I'll put a breakpoint right here. But before I hit F5, one thing I'm going to do is want to make sure that I've got my browser selected. I do. So I've got Edge selected. I've got a couple of other targets there. Go ahead and leave that selected. But before I run this, I want to open up Launch Settings JSON. And what you'll see here is that we've got the Swagger UI page now set as your default startup page. In the old days, you just land on a blank page. We made that a little bit better, and we set it up so that you would land on the GET output of an API call. But we know that people like to do other things other than GET, so we wanted to make all of that a little bit easier for you. So now that I've got that, if I can find my mouse again, I go up here, and I'll just go ahead and hit F5. And what you'll see is going to go ahead and start the app up in IIS, and it's going to pop up in my browser. And here's my browser right here. It's going to go ahead and launch us directly into the Swagger UI page. And remember that I've got that breakpoint set over here in my controller. Flip back over here. Uh-oh, that's odd. That would happen now. So there we go. I'll go ahead and open this up. I'll click try it out. And if I hit execute, you see right in that method already. But we didn't stop there. We wanted to make it easier for you to do a bunch of other things as well. So what I want to show you now is how we've been able to add in the ability for you to do more stuff when it comes to more complicated requests. I'll drop in a post here, some code that I already have pre-written in another window. I'll put the breakpoint here one more time. And this time when I run it, what you'll see again is that we've looked at that controller. We've already generated the post request. If I hit try it out, we've already generated the payload, and it's pretty cold at my house. It feels like it's 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's like pretty cold. So right now I'll just go down here and I'll click execute, and you'll see that that payload comes right through right here inside of my VS editor. And final thing we did, I want to show you the last thing. We've actually updated the .NET HTTP REPL, which is a fantastic .NET global tool that you can use from the command line to test your APIs. Now I'll hit F5. You'll see that that's now going to open up directly inside of my HTTP REPL. And if I just really quickly do an LS, or I could do a dir if I'm more dir focused. There we go. And I'll CD into the weather forecast. And then right here, I can do a get. And then there's all the stuff. Or if I wanted to, I could do a post. My favorite editor will open up. I'll just leave it here. Say brr, because it seems cold. Close this. And when it does the post, you'll see there is our payload coming right over. We think this is going to make it a lot easier for folks out there like myself and like you who are building APIs to share those APIs with other platforms and to use them in the Power Platform, publish them to Azure, and generate clients for it. We hope that you take a look at this and come to the session tomorrow to learn more. Back to you, Scott.
Thanks, Brady. So next, let's talk about Project Tai. This is a really cool piece of tech that it's in prototype or preview now. And we'll ship it in the .NET 5 timeframe. The first thing that it does is it makes it easy to build, debug, and deploy microservices with .NET. And it starts in one way. As you start building more than one application, how do they find the IP addresses and ports of each other? And so it has service discovery. It also has the feature of being able to, you know, let's say you're building a microservice and you want to depend on SQL or something like Redis Cache. Do you want to install that locally? Probably not. I don't want to put that on my dev box. Well, you can just add these dependencies to your Tai project, and we'll automatically go and grab the containers and run those things for you automatically without putting them on your box where they could mess your box up. Next is I want to be able to run and debug these things using Kubernetes and containers. I don't even have to know anything. I can just actually just Tai run these things and it'll just do that stuff for it. Then the next thing is, what if I'm building my application locally and I'm running all these multiple applications? Well, how would I find the logs? How would I find the ports and IPs of all these things? How would I find the perf counters? Well, we give you an awesome dashboard. You can find all this information super easily. And then finally, how do you take all that and easily deploy it to the cloud? Tai solves all these things for you, and I'm super excited to have this shipping in .NET 6 next year. And with that, I want to introduce David Fowler to come and do a quick demo of Project Tai.
Hey, everyone. Let's talk about Tai. All right. So here I have the world's simplest microservice, the front end and the back end. The front end itself is a simple application that calls the back end and renders a simple page. The back end is an API that has weather information, and the front end calls that. So the first thing we'll do is look at the startup class here, and you can see there's a call configured to get the backend address. As Scott was saying, if you run a ton of applications locally, you end up having to have ports for each service. Tai will resolve the correct port for the service name backend without having to worry about that issue. So my app runs locally. Let's see. Let's start the application. Typically, I have to go here to the solution, click on properties, click on this, start end projects that run locally. On the command line, it's even harder. I have to open end consoles, run each application in the right order, and start the application. What if I could run a single command to launch it? So my app is here on the console. I can do Tai run to launch the application. And it boots up the application, and it gives me a nice dashboard to see what's happening. So it builds the projects, launches each one, and now I can open up localhost with port 8000 to see what's happening on the application. Let's do that. So Tai gives me a dashboard that shows me my services running. You can see I have the front end and back end service running. I can see the source of the project. I can see the address and bindings. I can see the replicas, restarts, and logs. Let's make sure the app is working. So I'll hit the front end, and the front end page works well. Hit F5, and it refreshes the page and temperature. So that's working. The front end hits the back end, gets information, and shows a table of weather information. Now let's view the logs for this service to see what's happening. This is very handy in case I'm trying to debug issues that may happen when running services locally. As you can see, it's making a request from the front end to the back end API to get weather information here. I'm returning a 200. That's all good. I can also get metrics, as Scott was saying, for my application. So you can see I have counters here for ASP.NET Core, .NET Core, and other things. And my application is so efficient in .NET 5 that my fragmentation for GC is none. All right, so the app is now local and running. Let's get this application into the cloud quickly. So to get it into Kubernetes, I need to create Docker files for each application, one for the front end, one for the back end, push somewhere, and then I have to learn Kubernetes, write manifest for Kubernetes. What if I could automate all of that with one command? So I'll run tie deploy dash I, and it will automate those steps for me. So I'll give it my Docker Hub account to push my images there, and it will build projects, create container images, deploy those to Docker Hub under my account with versions, create Kubernetes manifest for each service, and apply it to the current Kubernetes context on my machine, which happens to be an AKS cluster running in Azure right now. So it's finishing up the deployment. And as you can see, that's pretty quick. I can run kube control get pause to show that it is running in the cloud. So my app is running in Kubernetes. Two pods are working. And let me show you the services. So as you can see, I have the front end and back end running, but they only have cluster IPs. So I can't access these from my local machine because they're only internally visible. So I'll run a command here that is port forward, which lets me push traffic from my local machine to Kubernetes without having to expose it on port 8080. So I'll go in here and I'll run localhost port 8080, and it will show the application running. So this is running in Kubernetes in Azure, but I'm being forwarded to my local machine via port forward. But what if I want to expose it to everyone in the conference? Let's do that. So I can run tie init to create a tie YAML file. And tie YAML is where I can actually do things like add dependencies of containers, configure ports, configure connection strings and environment variables. But I'm going to add a simple ingress rule right here now to my application. And this rule says, whenever somebody hits my cluster on the main page, route to the front end service. So very simple rule. And this runs locally and remotely, but I'm going to redeploy the application now. So I'll tie deploy dash I to push it back into Kubernetes. And it's running, publishes the front end first, and the back end. It's going. And it will recognize these new ingress rules and apply those to Kubernetes as well. And we'll see that in just a split second. Verifying installation. There we go. It's all running. So if I kube control get ingress, I'll have an ingress rule now added, but the address isn't there yet. So this normally takes a couple of minutes to show up sometimes. So I'll look at the services and get the IP address of my load balancer, which is the same thing. And now I have my app running in Kubernetes on AKS, publicly exposed to anyone. Please don't hack me at the moment. When you're finished, you can run tie and deploy to tear down the resources in Kubernetes that were created. And this should cleanly tear down things that were added by the tool. And if I kube control get all, I should see no resources. They're being terminated at the moment. And they're gone. So if I have F5 here, it's all down and clean and torn down. Awesome. Back to you, Scott.
Thanks so much, David. It's an awesome demo showing how fast you can build microservices with .NET and get them running in Kubernetes. So now, what's next? What are we doing going forward? Last year, we shared a broad vision of a singular .NET stack and ecosystem. We're happy to report that we have now have the foundation in place to deliver on that vision in .NET 6. And we'll continue to unify the platform in the next wave of releases. We're working towards a single SDK, one set of base class libraries, and a unified tool chain. You saw today that down payment today in Blazor in .NET 5 now uses the .NET Core libraries instead of the Mono libraries. And we'll bring that next to the Xamarin workloads in .NET 6. We plan to deliver amazing unified tool chains, awesome cross-platform native UI with .NET MAUI. You saw today some of the amazing cross-platform web UI with Blazor. And I hope to have Blazor running on the desktop in the future as well. You saw some of the cloud native investments. We obviously will continue to work on performance and diagnostics and stuff like that. And I believe that .NET will provide the best breed solution for all modern workloads when we're complete of this journey. Now, now that .NET 5 is out today, going forward, you're going to see we always have a release every year. And we do this because we want to make it very consistent. And so you understand when the next version of .NET is going to come and when our open source partners know when the next version of .NET is going to come. You'll also notice that every other year is a long-term support release. But I will tell you, moving forward, our goal is to make it very easy to move from version to version. So you shouldn't have to think you have to wait for an LTS. You should be able to jump right on .NET 5 today. It'll be supported for the entire year. And then just move to .NET 6 next year when it comes out. So .NET 5 is available today. Go and download it. I do want to mention that the release of Visual Studio 16.8 was delayed just a little bit. It was supposed to come out at 8 o'clock Pacific Standard Time when we started this conference. It's now going to come out around 10 o'clock. So it's about 30 to 40 minutes from now. It should be available. And so when it's out, go and grab it. And with that, I want to thank everybody for joining me today. And please watch all the other sessions. As I said, we have 100 amazing speakers across 80 sessions over the next couple of days. Go try .NET 5. And thanks for being here.